Welcome to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and get ready to emancipate your mind and radically expand your imagination as we present all the most exciting and revolutionary possibilities of our times, both locally and globally. I hope you enjoy it, and as always, solidarity today, tomorrow, and forever. Welcome to a new episode of Another World is Potable. We had this guest on previously, and he was so fantastic, and I think his views are going to be even more pertinent in light of all the things that are happening right now in terms of the coronavirus and the kind of, I would say, really economic crisis this has brought up as well. So I want to welcome back Keir Milburn. Keir, thanks for coming back on, man.
Thanks for having me back, Pete. It's good. It's not that long ago we talked, and yet it is a different world.
Yes. What's that famous Lenin quote? Sometimes decades happen in a matter of weeks,
yeah.
And it feels like that. I think, previously we talked more broadly about the relationship between kind of generational divides and also, what that can mean for constructing a radical politics in another world and, creating another world. But I wanted to have you back on specifically, not just because I always enjoyed speaking to you, but because I think that this notion of a generation gap has become even more acute as this kind of pandemic has taken hold and as it's had kind of different both health and socioeconomic effects on different age groups. One of the things before we get into the more detailed analysis of this is, in a sense, you've been kind of thinking about this and writing about it, for going on, half a decade. And it's interesting just, to start with, how has these events kind of reinforced some of the things that you've kind of been looking at and that you've written about and actually kind of transformed and changed them?
It's a really difficult question to answer, partly because there's this weird time, there's this like 2-week time lag that's going on in with the coronavirus. You can contract it, you can walk around and spread it, and yet, you won't know you've had it until sort of like perhaps 5-10 days into it, serious trouble if you're going to get into serious trouble and perhaps die. That's not going to happen for another five or so days. And so it's quite difficult to work. Basically, we have to do a bit of prediction work. So if one of the things that's concerning people at the moment is they're looking at the approval rate, Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, both of who have really completely fucked up the response to the crisis, yet they have very high risk approval ratings. But like those are like little time capsules from a previous age. Even if they're just made today, what they're showing is the response people will have to the actions that the government is doing today, because the consequences of those actions won't be visible until a fortnight's time. So they're a little bit like sort of time capsules. We're trying to predict what impact this will have on like perhaps political views, but you can't look at real time data because it doesn't make sense. Do you know what I mean? So it's a difficult one. But the other thing, of course, is we sort of don't know how this is going to pan out, because we've got two things going on. As you mentioned, we've got this pandemic, this global pandemic, and we know that this is going to get incredibly more serious. I listened to a doctor, an intensive care doctor, who was predicting that the UK is going to run out of intensive care beds by this Sunday or this Monday. So what day are we recording? We're recording the 25th of March. Basically, by next Monday, doctors are going to be deciding who lives and who dies, because that's basically what happens if you get really intense, if you get the pneumonia with this, and they're going to be looking and they're going to be deciding that old people are going to die and they're not going to treat them. That is something which is it's just huge. And, the figures we're looking at, in the US, if Donald Trump's talk, you know, the right are sort of floating this idea that perhaps the economic cost of saving people is too high. They're trying to do a cost benefit analysis. You know, the economic costs are too high, and so we should just abandon the quarantine. I don't think that will float because like the implications of that are something like 1.5 million deaths, excess deaths in the US. I don't think anybody can sort of float that through, no matter what economic analysis you do. But you know, and so there's this we don't know what the dimension of the pandemic will be. That depends on sort of government action, the way people act. But then what we do know is that that also has a huge economic effect, and that economic effect is the thing which will probably last longer. Both of these have got distinct effects. Do you know what I mean? How to work through, and we're almost certainly looking at a depression of a much larger scale than the 1930s following this. You know,
I mean,
no, go on.
no, I mean, and I think that the reason I was interjecting that I thought was interesting about this is something that you've kind of worked on before, but I think is often really forgotten, is that the for older people. For older generations, if I can say that, there's this kind of intra-class issue as well. And when we often hear about, oh, well, a lot of people who are older are more politically conservative, or, you know, it's oftentimes a very, like, as you say, a snapshot, not just in time, but of a specific demographic within this demographic. And it's been interesting to me to kind of see how actually a lot of chronic problems. That do affect particularly older people who are poor, such as, I mean, you probably know these figures much more than myself, so I apologize, but you know, there's so many who die because their heating is turned off. You know, and so all of a sudden, the ways in which I think there has been an implicit kind of, you know, this is just collateral damage of austerity or neoliberalism, has now, I think, come to the forefront. And I do think it is something in which, you know, really being raised about what kind of society do we live in where we just allow this kind of hidden population of older people to, you know, we choose to let them die, whether it's because of our economic system or now because of this pandemic with lack of resources.
Yeah, I mean, it's the pandemic is incredibly pedagogical. It just really has revealed this huge amount about our society. And I mean, you know, the likes of me and you probably know it, but we probably need to relearn it when you see it in action. Do you know what I mean? And so I mean, the immediate thing that you realize is, you know, how interdependent we are, all these bonds of dependency, which are normally obscured. You know, I quipped on Twitter the other day that like it's taken you know, widespread social distancing for us to recognize our interdependence. Do you know what I mean? And one of the reasons that is because usually there's all this work that goes on which is obscured from us. Infrastructural work, all of these, you know, the logistics that go into stocking supermarkets, etc. And then like care work, all of this care and social reproductive work, we never see that until it starts to go wrong. Right. And so, you know, that is obscured. And now it's visible. And the conditions under which people do that work is suddenly visible for the precise reason that those conditions all of a sudden may kill us. Right. As in, you know, if somebody hasn't got sick pay, right, and they are forced to go to work, as we're discovering now, when they're sick and they deliver your package. And the virus survives on the cardboard for 48 hours or whatever. Well, you need to know about that all of a sudden. And, you know, all of a sudden you sort of realize there's a sort of real universal to this. There's lots of divisions as well, which we'll probably get into in a moment. There's a dynamic in that. All of a sudden you sort of recognize, you know, nobody in a pandemic, no one is safe. No one has access to healthcare if unless everybody has access to healthcare. If the person who is stocking your supermarket shelves doesn't care, it's going to impact on you, right? So it reveals all of these things. But you're also right as well. It also reveals these, you know, it reveals that we do these calculations about how many people we are prepared to die and who mournable or grievable. Judith Butler says, just started reading Judith Butler's book on nonviolence, which is all about these bonds of dependency, quite relevant. So it's a hugely pedagogical. We can sort of see all of this. One of the ironies, actually, obviously, I've been addicted to social media. My addiction to social media has got even worse during this pandemic because it's contact with the outside world, you know. And then just recently in the UK, there's lots of debates, you know, about people. So the Times yesterday was an article that, you know, economic crises and reduced spending on social services, etc., because of decrease in the size of the economy, that costs lives. So we have to offset them against the lives lost to the pandemic. Response to that is, yes, we know that. We just told you that about austerity for the last 10 years. We've been holding up these death figures from austerity for the last 10 years. And the right wing have been saying that that doesn't exist. But it's a hugely pedagogical moment where all sorts of things have been exploded and being made visible.
I mean, I was really interested, with the outcry, and understandably so, that I think Dominic Cummings had when it was revealed, and though the government has pushed back against this, and like, oh, well, you know, we're just going to have, you know, acceptable number of deaths. And you know, people, I think we're very upset by this, understandably, but I was interested in, and I'd like, you know, your view on this in terms of, you know, better understanding some of the historical precedents for this, is that this is not something new per se. It's just something that's being said out loud. I mean, I've been very cognizant over the last 10 years about, and it's something I know you've discussed about, you know, how discourses around retirement ages and austerity has emerged. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, when do you, like, you know, once you become older, you're not productive anymore, so you're not valuable. And therefore, you know, we have to, you know, tighten our belts and we have to raise the retirement age and make sure that you're as productive as possible for as long as possible. And then on the other side of that, generationally, I mean, there was this kind of almost tacit acceptance that following the 2008 crisis, and then, you know, it's been 10 years that, well, you know, this is just a lost economic generation. You know, I mean, there's, you know, what can we really do about it? And no matter how many times you would say, well, there's a variety of things we can do about it, there was this kind of very easy writing off of quote unquote millennials as well. Hopefully we get it better the next generation. Like they just got to face, you know, a deteriorating late capitalism. So I thought it might be kind of interesting, because I know you've said it more depth, how these actually reflect in maybe more explicit ways already kind of existing discourses around different generations and their expendability.
Yeah, that's before I get to that, you raised something earlier about this sort of like, basically it's just a market, it's a market logic, isn't it? What we're seeing revealed is like the market logic is if you marketize healthcare, then you get the healthcare that you can pay for, basically. And we've seen in a pandemic, there's another economy that's going on, and that's like what the moral economy, as E.P. Thompson once talked about it, you know, basically people push back against that, right? So I thought that when, right at the beginning, you know, right at the beginning of this new world last week, there was quite a few instances of shaming of people who were buying up toilet roll. There was a guy in America who'd bought up, in fact, it was hand sanitizer, all the hand sanitizer in one state in America. And then eBay changed the rules and he couldn't sell it, and like outpouring of hate towards him. And yet, you know, that is, I imagine he went to the news thinking he should have been a hero. Right, because he's fulfilling that entrepreneurial spirit. That's the sort of person we're supposed to look up to. All of a sudden, he looks like a murderer. So there is a moral economy going on underneath the market. Times of crisis, the moral economy trumps the market economy, I think. Of course, that has to get through. That's the sort of picture that E.P. Thompson set up in talking about the movement into a market society. about like food riots, etc., and all these sorts of things, is showing this moral economy come into conflict with a market economy. And you can see that that's sort of come back now. But underneath that, there are all sorts of stuff about starting to calculate people's worth on their productivity. And so in that case, older people or retired people are going to be less valuable, which is like this. There's all sorts of incredible ironies and probably tragedies about this, the characteristic where the older more at risk and the younger at less at risk. And so the older more reliant on the productivity of the young, etc. Because we've lived through an era for the last 10 years and probably before that where in fact productivity has not actually been valued, weirdly. Valued in economic policy. In fact, productivity in a country such as the UK has been really flat for quite a long time, for a decade, and there's not been much investment in business, etc., business investment to raise productivity. And in fact, the interests which have been sort of driving this are those who are productive and earn, but those who own assets, basically, and stocks. And so one of the things that underlay the generational political divide was a divide in material. People look to see their material interests, and you know, the older populations over 65s, the property pensioners, which doesn't encompass everybody, doesn't encompass 25% of the population of pensioners in the UK don't own their own home, so they're excluded from this. The interests of older people were aligned to the financial sector, and there's no doubt what we've seen over the last 10 years is the needs of the financial sector getting addressed at the expense of both other people and other sectors of the economy. And all of a sudden, the financial sector looks, you know, I don't think they are key essential workers. They're talking about closing the spot stock market, actually, at the moment. And so, you know, you can see that like older people have got their interests aligned to the financial sector, younger people, their interests are not there, their interests to work, to wages, et cetera, et cetera. And so when we look at what's happening to this, so the response to 2008 was huge amounts of quantitative easing, the financial sector gets what it's likes, the rest of the economy and the rest of the population can go hang. In fact, they have to go and pay for it. You are seeing huge quantities of quantitative easing, etc., to try and increase liquidity to keep the financial markets going. But you're also seeing attention paid to incomes because it's such a weird crisis. Mm. We basically want people not to work and we have to pay people not to work. Good God. I mean, that's what I've wanted. But I mean, so, yeah, the logic is it's a really strange situation because the logic of the situation is You need something that looks like a universal guaranteed basic income, and then you need some form of planned allocation of resources. That's just broadly obvious. And you've seen quite a lot of people who are not on the left say, well, look, it's straightforward. That's what you need to do. And we're seeing moves towards that, but there's huge resistance to implementing those two. The resistance comes not from the fact that governments think that those measures won't work. Their fear is that those... Right. And once you establish universal basic income, it gets very hard to justify withdrawing that. Right. Because, you know, we say, well, look, you save these lives. What about all these lives that are going to, we're going to lose once we withdraw that? And it's the same for like, you know, planned allocation of resources. We do live in primarily a planned economy now rather than a market economy. All that planning takes place in huge logistical companies. But as soon as you set this up, huge logistical planning alongside, which also gets revealed in this moment, alongside, you know, a much more interventionist state, you start to think, well, look, we've got a choice. Two types of planned economy, a democratically planned economy, which doesn't necessarily have to be top-down, or a planned economy, which is a top-down planned economy, but, you know, under the control of private companies and for the pursuit of profit and not for... the satisfaction of needs. So it'd be, you know, you could have a planned economy which addresses the moral economy or a planned economy which addresses the market economy, and those are distinct Do you know what I mean? Sorry, I went into a rant there. I can't remember where I started.
No. I think it's perfect. And I think, you know, I really like that point that you've made. I mean, where it's the fear about so much of these measures is not that they won't work, but they will work. And I think what's been incredible about this is the fact that we're actually now really starting to articulate in a very real way, you know, what do we need in terms of essential labor in this society? I mean, you know, and it's not just that I think the financial markets are being, you know, revealed as, you know, fairly unproductive at best and really harmful at worst, but also, you know, do we need CEOs? Do we need executives? Do we need insurance salesmen? Mm. Like, you know, who are the people that really make the economy go? And I think that there has been a really strong kind of recognition, even at the highest levels, that, you know, there's a greater knowledge now that not only, you know, should we have things that are kind of post, you know, point to kind of a post-work society like universal basic income, but that this is largely because we don't actually need to do all the work that we do. And so much of the work that they force us to be quote unquote productive or marketable is really just about, you know, allowing for the profits of a small few. Like, it's not actually necessary. And I think that's a real fear as well. But there's also a point that I think you brought up that I thought was really interesting about the interdependence and about, which is, you brought this up earlier, which is about, you know, we're starting to realize our bonds with each other. And I've been really struck in these conversations, and you see this in the US as well, about the fact that for the first time, the gig economy and precarious workers and ways in which so many people fall, you know, through these kind of ambiguous cracks of employment, right, are now really being acknowledged. And there's a kind of sense of, well, we can't just give universal basic income to, you know, people who are easily identifiable on a payroll, for instance. Like, we actually now have to identify, you know, everyone who's working. And we have to really make sure that everyone, especially people who are the most precarious and therefore the most vulnerable, are getting, you know, supported. So I think that's also been interesting to see the ways in which, you know, you're right, we have this extremely planned economy that's also relies on informality. And this has forced, I think, a stronger recognition of our bonds and, you know, a formalization of these, at least in policy discussions.
Yeah. One of the other things I've been trying to think through as well is, because I've been trying to think about how this plays out generationally, you know, and it's very, very difficult to work out. But one of the things I've been trying to think through is, because one of the things I've been become convinced about is culture war, sort of anti-woke right, sort of culture war that is raised in the US and has been a huge effort to introduce it into the UK. But that is one of the things that really suffers at this moment, right? Because if you think about, you know, the story of that anti-woke right is, of like Generation Snowflake, which is, you know, all of these young people, they can't take responsibility for themselves. They, you know, look at us, we pulled ourselves up by the bootstraps. You know, we are, you know, we take responsibility for our own life. Nobody else is going to do it for you, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand is our people who are saying, well, you know, well, look, you know, there are also sort of structural forces going on. There's patriarchy, there's racial structures, there's imperialism, there's capitalism, all of these in our lives, basically. And you can see that as just this two sides of this, what Wendy Brown called neoliberal responsibilization, right? Which is like, you know, the elimination of politics, the elimination of the notion of like social structures and the idea that are just individuals and each individual is responsible for their own outcomes. Well, that is obviously false now. We can actually see that, like, you know, all of a sudden we can see that, like, this sense of autonomy that, like, the wealthy have, and which I think underlies the sort of, like, what you might call the boomer anti-wokeism, right? like, which is like the sort of denial of the fact that our actions are actually dependent on other people, on the work of other people, but also impact on other people and onto other things such as the environment. Now, I think that denialism, and the high part of that is like denial of climate change, etc. That sort of like this new, that what was the emerging structure of the sort of ethno-nationalist and this new post-crisis, right, the disaster nationalism, as Richard Seymour puts it. You know, I think that can't survive this moment, right, because it is so obvious that all of our bonds of dependence, impacts of our actions are suddenly visible, really, really clearly visible because of this pandemic. So I wonder what happens to that. Like, how does, so my what I'm trying to think through is that, well, what, I think that was the direction that the right were going in pre the pandemic, and they were winning. I always thought that, right? I always thought that would not be able to survive contact with reality. I thought it would be the reality of climate change and then reality of the economic recession that was coming anyway. Before this pandemic, we were on the route to an economic recession. I thought those would be the things which would confound the expectations of what we might call right. And I was predicting that, in fact, the general coordinates of the worldview of like Generation Left, the young left, would be confirmed over the next 10 years. And I think it has been through this crisis. So my question is then, how will the right reform its through this pandemic and after this pandemic? Mm. And one of the things I've got in mind is in 2008, you have this huge crisis, of a financial crisis, and all talk is about we need to reform the financial sector. But within 6 months, the right had reformed that story around, away from the financial sector, around sovereign debt, and therefore the answer would be austerity, right? So the actual original crisis was disappeared. The 2008 crisis got disappeared. It basically, especially in the UK, it got disappeared behind, you know, government deficits, which of course could not possibly have had any impact to start that recession. So that was a fantastically effective method of reframing what was going on. I've been really racking my brains to think about how could the right reframe this. Obviously, they're trying to do it in racist terms, with Trump trying to talk about the Chinese virus, etc. I don't think that's going to also sort of see it in what you were referring to earlier about attempts to shift the blame for the huge, huge thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of deaths that are going to unfold in the UK over the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks, shift the blame from that away from the government and onto the public, because they're going out to the beach, etc. And amongst that public, it's young males who seem to be the major target of this initial attempt for blame. You know, I think that is also, but in my head, that seems more like a legacy of, you know, that blame the young sort of a thing which won't survive the real depth of this crisis, both the pandemic and then this huge economic collapse that we're going to be experiencing over the next 6 months.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a really strong question, and one that's quite profound. And I think a lot of us are thinking about it, because there's a long-term, I mean, this is going to cause a long-term political realignment. How that plays out demographically and electorally is one thing, but certainly I think you're right that there's a cultural common sense in the deepest terms, like, that are changing. And how the right is going to be able to reformulate itself is, you know, I think you already see signs of it. I think I think the racism part is going to be less key than the racialization part and the ethno-nationalism part. So I think they're already beginning to see this kind of idea of like, okay, well, you know, there's these, you know, areas that are really, really in these countries that are really, really, you know, not able to take care of themselves, and they cause these global pandemics, and therefore we have to close our borders, or we have to have more control, etc. But I think that is also going to be matched by, you know, two points that I think you touched upon. One, I mean, I think that there's going to be a very strong move towards kind of neoliberal regulation and control attempts. You know, really being able to track people's behavior more, demand that they act in a certain way, and really, like you said, turn this from a question of structural problems to personal behavior problems, which will open up the ability to be even more authoritarian in how they try to monitor what people can and can't do and use algorithmic governance for that purpose. I also see a point, and you know, I think this is something that is often forgotten, and I mean, it's really important that the logics of eugenics and this kinds of notion of, you know, good and bad genes and public health has never really gone away. And in fact, it's played very strongly in elite circles within neoliberalism, you know. So I would say that someone like Trump, for instance, I think it's wrong to think he's just a standard boilerplate racist or merely an ethno-nationalist opportunist, right? I think that, you know, it's very clear that he has an idea that, you know, he and his family are deserving of success because they have good genes. They come from good stock. And I think a real danger is how that's going to start playing out in mainstream discourses. And it was telling that this notion of herd immunity, you know, was like the first response they had, you know? And it really is this dangerous idea that, you know, some people just are not a good stock and therefore, you know, probably should be let out the pasture, so to speak, or let to die. And I think that's going to be dangerous. But I agree that I mean, I think all those things are, in a sense, going to be have a lot of trouble, because I think, you know, the 2008 crisis was an economic crisis. And there was a lot, it was a pedagogical moment, as you've said, but it was also one in which people were still learning certain things about what was going on. I think the 10 years since then, there's been a real awakening, even if it isn't always reflected politically, about, oh, what are our interdependencies? I think that if, you know, I mean, there's a real, you know, there's a real ways in which a lot of ideas that are fundamental to neoliberalism is working against it. Because if there's one thing that neoliberalism has asked us to be in the last 10 years is resilient. And now it's a question of, well, you can't even stop your own economy for 1 week to deal with the global pandemic. Like, how resilient are you actually? So I think it's going to be interesting, because I think a lot of the logics and justifications are, you know, really being challenged and weakened. So, but I think, you know, this does bring us to a point that I wanted to explore with you more is, you know, I've been very, very fascinated by the discourses both around the right and the left around this kind of generation gap and our generational solidarity. Because I do think that we are in a time of massive change ideologically. But even with that, I think some age-old kind of ideas are still here. Like, so I think I've heard a lot about, okay, well, this should reflect, you know, and help to bridge our generational divides. And I think that sounds great in principle, but it's still a kind of ignoring, and I can just imagine yourself metaphysically, metaforically, I hope that literally banging your head against the wall, would, you know, it's still kind of being presented as it's just something that we should all do and that there's nothing, you know, stopping us from doing it. And the only reason that we don't do it is because old people don't care about young people, and young people don't care about old people, as opposed to a real serious structural analysis of the political and material conditions as to why this is difficult and what we actually need to do to overcome and allow for the solidarity to exist. So I think that's the longest I ever spoke at one time during my own podcast, but I apologize. But, you know, I now want to give you quite a bit of time to kind of explore that, because I've been so frustrated with that, that this idea that continues to reoccur, that this is just a, you know, a sense of changing our attitudes. And, you know, I don't think that really does us any good. So
No, yeah, you may totally. I mean, you know, one of the things that came out immediately was this idea that there's some sort of generational tension, but suddenly the boot is on the other foot. So whereas the older cohorts have been voting and getting the governments they want, all of a sudden, you know, they're now dependent on the young, basically. They're dependent on the young behaving in socially responsible ways. And you know, on one side it's that, you know, irresponsible young men, and on the other side it's like, oh, at last we've got a boomer remover. It's going to remove the boomers and et cetera, et cetera. But you're right, you know, so this sort of like the generational distinctions. I mean, the first thing is first of all, there's that this huge like cosmic tragedy of the fact that there's a coincidence between the fact that this pandemic has arrived just too late to change circumstances and save these related projects, the Corbyn and Sanders project, right? They both collapse just before this pandemic comes along, and the pandemic sort of proves both of their worldviews. Do you know that is that older people have basically voted to close off a political project whose policy they now desperately need. Right. And so this is huge cosmic, you know, tragedy about that in some ways. And like who really defeated them was probably the centrist neoliberal left. Right. There's certainly the Democratic Party's shenanigans, the whole shenanigans, you know, the whole campaign, the war against Corbyn, et cetera. And I think if we could agree about anything that's not going to come out of this, it's not going to be a return to the sort of world of 1997 to 2006 or something. It's not going to be that world, the world of the third way left. That's gone forever. Just at the point where people who are more towards that, well, in fact, you know, in Joe Biden's, in reference to Joe Biden, you know, he's even worse than Clinton in that respect. So basically, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the centrist neoliberal campaign to close off the left has worked to a certain extent. There was a project to sort of like to do this immediate leap from nowhere to take control of the two of the most powerful states in the world, the US and the UK. It was an audacious attempt. It came much closer than we ever thought it had possible. But that's been closed off perhaps the week before the pandemic hits us. Absolutely insane cosmic coincidence. So you know, where does that leave us? You know, what that leaves us is the need for, you know, the need for to reinvent the left for this new situation. So what we're saying, in fact, that, you know, even though that movement is that's an audacious leap and seize control of the two of the biggest states in the world, even though those that failed, and we can say now that's over. You know, I know Bernie's still in it, but it's basically over. Even though that failed, what happened was, you know, that attempt was always an attempt which was trying to backfill movements around it. In fact, it has in the UK and the US, it has recreated a viable left with huge amount of intellectual energy. It didn't actually create that many social movements, but now, you know, perhaps we could say that cosmic tragedy of like movements, that those attempts to seize control of the state being closed off, it means now not that the slate is clean, but like, you know, we have a new project now. We have a new project, we have a really new situation, and we have a left which is in existence. And we have a left which has been in existence as the only part of the political sphere, which is why it is the point of reference even for far right governments at the moment. And so the situation we're in is we're in this bizarre situation where we're all locked down in our houses, well, not completely. It's really hard to think of how the left would act in the normal way it would act, which is to create these moments of co-presence, i.e. demonstrations, big meetings, etc. All of these not possible. We see this huge emergence of mutual aid networks, you know, which originate with the anarchist movement in this country. 2.5 million people signed up on Facebook. That is a case of intergenerational solidarity, because it's got to be. It has to be younger people who are less at risk of the from the crisis, from the pandemic, from the coronavirus, going out and you know, supporting people who are more at risk, who will be predominantly older, etc. So what happens in this meantime, though? You know, we get there's some of that going on. You know, I was thinking about this actually, that, like, you know, what is the conditions of this quarantine? It means that we're basically isolated from one another physically, in physical distance. But, you know, that's been the tendency of society for a long time. You know, people talk about a bowling alone, etc., the breakdown, these social bonds, that, you know, the fact that we work more and more, so we have less time to interact with each other. So perhaps what we're doing now, we're learning how to deal with this, the difficulty of getting together physically in the same place. You know, I'm talking organized, but perhaps we're learning how to organize in a world of isolation, which will still be there to a much lesser extent when we come out of quarantine, because we are living we'll have the sort of lives which are isolated from each other much more. I mean, the other thing is, we may have lots of people with free time. We have to be paid not to work, which will give us some sort of free time. Like, that has been the most precious commodity ever. So already you're seeing people sort of create sort of institutions that might help us, you know, help us think about, well, what could we do with that free time in a productive way? So you're seeing these Labour Transform set up this virtual social centre the other day, in which they've got lots of resources. I think they're going to have sort of, you know, virtual meetings. They've got a virtual bar where people can hang out together and drink, etc. I know there are lots of plans to do sort of like political education work, to teach courses, to etc. in a sort of structured way. The World Transformed, they're all holding these really large Zoom meetings to try and coordinate and talk, to discuss how we respond to the coronavirus. And like that is the sort of project, I think, when we're locked up, when we can't, it's really hard to think how we exercise any leverage. Do you know what I mean? Our normal leverage, the normal leverage of the workers' movement since it began, was to withdraw our work. That doesn't work. That's not a useful strategy when we're being asked not to work, you know, and the quarantine's got to get more. It will be, you know, in the US where they may not introduce quarantine, and even in the UK where you have large sectors of businesses still open, you know, basically a strike is what's called for. But outside that, how do we exercise, you know, some measure of power? It has to be things such as rent strikes, debts, etc. These sorts of things have to be thought about, I think.
I mean, there's so much there, and I think that analysis is really, really rich and profound. And one of the aspects that I think you touch upon is kind of where does the left go from here, but more fundamentally, what kinds of narratives are going to emerge from this? And if of all the groups that I think have been a complete failure during this time, which I think you're right, is this kind of centrist, kind of center-left neoliberalism, you know, that's represented by people like, you know, Biden. I actually think in a certain really perverse way, they have, and I say this literally and figuratively, a kind of Trump card, which is, they still have an effective discourse of what I have called in some of my own work, this kind of, you know, narrative of recovery, right? And so there's this idea that, you know, we just have to recover, you know, the past. We have to go back to the time before a
pandemic. Back to normal.
Back to normal. The time before a crisis. You know, Biden, back to normal. Back to normal. Exactly. And I have to admit, I mean, I've been, you know, shocked, and I probably shouldn't have been, but, you know, I think the Biden candidacy is one of the most interesting political phenomenon, wherever you stand on the thing, for, you know, generations, just in the sense that he doesn't really seem to have any grassroots movement, fair enough. He's almost completely funded by billionaires, okay? That's not entirely surprising, but even the kind of bare minimum of, you know, and I want to say this, you know, without, you know, as nicely as possible, or diplomatically as possible, the bare minimum of just being able to speak more than 10 minutes.
Any qualification for a politician, the ability to finish a sentence.
And like you've said, I mean, the Sanders movement is so interesting right now, is that precisely at the moment in which, you know, and I will say that while I think there has been shenanigans, I think Sanders has also, and we could talk about this in a moment because I think it's important, make huge mistakes, but tactically and strategically, but he's actually emerged as this kind of real leader in this moment, right? Like he's holding, he's raising money, he's holding these town halls, he's working internally to help shape the debate, while Biden is completely AWOL. And the reason I think that's interesting, though, is because even in the midst of his absence, even in the midst of, in the first blush, people who, like Kamala Harris presenting, a policy in California that was immediately laughed down because it was so poor, or the first House bill by Nancy Pelosi that was immediately kind of said, I mean, she was like, "We're not giving direct payments," and even kind of center-right Democratic economists were like, "No, we
I mean,
have to
when
give
the chips
people
are down,
money."
though, I mean, the center, that sort of like center
But
pseudo left, neoliberal left, they are always the true believers, much more than the right.
oh yeah. Oh no, well, the right, I think this is very important. The right has always been opportunistic for their class, whereas the centrists, they've actually believed this first on a point of electability and then at a point of ideological truth. But what I think a really interesting part about this is, so despite all of this, I mean, you cannot imagine a less, serious candidate right now, or a less or a more deficient political movement than the center right now. And yet, I would say more than even the right, I mean, there are, really serious true believers. Like, people who will say things like, "Oh, well, it's all right for Biden not to have, really said anything, because, he's not a lawmaker, so he doesn't want to, create disunity at this time, or what can he do?" And so, I think this discourse of nostalgia and is really dangerous right now. But at the same time, I think that there's a real sense of we can't go back to the past. And I would actually say that you're seeing a different generational divide, because I think that a lot of people who are older are kind of now, well, just out of necessity, like, we need actually to do something more. And I think a lot of people who are under 35 or 30, and these are obviously broad swaths, are saying, "Look, we can't go back to what was, because what was before is what allowed this to happen." But I do actually think, and this has always been, there's this kind of 35 to 65 range that has always kind of stood in the middle, both again, age-wise, but also politically. And I've seen a real sense of nostalgia creep into, we just need to go back to Obama, right? We just need a bridge. And I think that's in many ways more dangerous than even the far right right now, because I think the far right, like you've said, it's much easier to push back, because I think they're going to have to go through a complete reconfiguration. I think they've been exposed as just representing their own class. But I think that it's that kind of nostalgia that is very, if I can, without being overly scientific about it, and I apologize, middle-aged,
But I think it's not quite
that
that.
is
I think
very
it's probably
dangerous.
something more like 40, 45 to 65 is like this sort of, but that is the third way. That is the third way era. That's if we, when we're, one of the sort of like shibboleths of sort of like generational analysis is that, the sort of events of your when you first, of your very early life, of your teens and then into your early 20s, events and the political mood of that time sort of tend to stick with you as a sort of baseline, which then can get adjusted by events afterwards. There's some truth to that, it seems to be. But if you think about, people who came of age, politically came of age, in the early 1990s, and I, you know, where you what you're seeing is the collapse of the Soviet Union, the basically the collapse of this workers' movement to some extent. This workers' movement, which had been building for like 150 years, all of a sudden, you know, the early 90s is we see the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then one of the consequences of that is what's known as the Great Double Labor Force, where the labor force accessible to global capital sort of doubles overnight, basically. Which obviously tanks the price of labor, which destroys the power of labor, and basically it seems to set this idea that radical change isn't possible, and in fact, only that, you know, changing the parameters of this new global the world of globalization, as we used to call it, the sort of neoliberal globalization, the world of the Washington Consensus. All of that is basically unchangeable, and so what you must do is just tinker a little bit, redirect a few resources, etc., which is basically the third way left. That is so ingrained as the common sense that for that cohort, that sort of neoliberal centrist cohort, like they cannot adjust to they couldn't adjust to the huge changes that came about from 2008, and so they've been pretty lost. They couldn't recognize this new generation left, right? Because, you know, basically new left generations grow up in the blind spots of the old generations, right? Particularly if the old left generations are in power, because the new generations come around by problematizing things that the old generation have done, right? And so my friend Jeremy Gilbert talks a lot about like the long 1990s, where this sort of this period is held up as like the eternal period, the end of history period, actually, as it is. And, you know, nothing can alter that, you know, the political lessons that people learned at that time are mistaken for universal lessons, etc. I just don't think that can survive, partly because the lessons of that time were the state can't do things. Socialized answers to social problems won't work. The market is efficient, and the market will address problems if enough room is given to the market, and if markets are structured in the right way. Well, like, if there's one thing that's absolutely failed in the face of this pandemic, are market relations. They are of no fucking use to us. Do you know what I mean? And so, you know, of course, I really, really do agree with this. Yes. This huge desire to get out of this crazy period we've been in for the last how long? I don't know. We could take it back to 2016. We could take it back to 2011. But at least since 2016, the world hasn't stopped making any sort of sense. You know, if you take the worldview of the pre-2008 era. And so some sort of, you know, response to, well, what's the response to Trump? Please, let's get rid of Trump. That's the starting point, wouldn't it? You know, and so a return to somebody who's not Trump, who has associations with the Obama era, that you could see some sort of attraction. That, you are right, that is exactly where any form of attraction to Joe Biden ends, because Jesus Christ, he's an incompetent, and it's seemingly in the early stages of dementia, and basically has awful politics, and completely out of time for the era that we live in. But it's really hard to think through, because that grasp to go back to normality is obviously the thing that's driven. I think the Labour Party leadership election, I don't think Keir Starmer is a Joe Biden type. I've been pretty disappointed by Keir Starmer's response to this crisis, where it has just been platitude after platitude and no sort of demands. And we'll be more open to pressure from below, from the left, basically. But Biden won't be, obviously won't be. But like, I think their worldview has collapsed. I think the right, I think when you were talking about racialization, I think you're really onto something there, and like all of these tropes about like wet markets and these irresponsible areas of the globe, etc., really comes into play. But I do think both of those worldviews are really under pressure, and the worldview that the immediate crisis puts wind in the sails is this sort of what I would call a generation left view, you know, the coordinates of the worldview that's been developed over the last 5 or 6 years, that's had a huge impetus put into its sales, I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and one of the aspects that I think is worth also though saying from what the left can learn from this, especially in terms of generational solidarity, is first of all, a much stronger analysis of the material conditions that prevent this. So let me we've talked about this, you know, it's like, I think that for a lot of older people, there is a certain just hanging on to the small things that you have, because this idea of uncertainty is quite worrying. If even if you own your own property, that's oftentimes the only thing that you really own. And then on the other end of it, you know, asking people not to go to work who are 25 working two jobs and have to pay rent, you know, and these are kinds of things that I think are saying, instead of just saying, you know, let's all get along by, you know, really looking at, okay, what do we need to do, you know, as a society and policy to promote this? But I also think, and it's something that you mentioned in terms of the ways in which we have, this gives us a chance to restructure our everyday existence and things like Labor Transformed are doing, et cetera, around this, is that we really have to take more seriously that the politics that matters in many ways is not going to be the ones you see, as Scott Herron says, on TV all the time. It's not going to be around liberal kind of bourgeois electoral cycles, but it is in the everyday material ways in which we are waging a battle over social existence and material reproduction, right? And I think that right now what you are seeing is that things that oftentimes don't get a lot of media attention, certainly, but have been growing, such as platform cooperativism, mutual solidarity networks, definitely cooperative and common-based development. These are things that have been somewhat on the periphery, I think, of public knowledge, but have definitely been on a much stronger place. And I think both of us can speak to this as people who've been involved in studying this and working around this for a couple of decades now. I mean, in the early 2000s, if you would have said commons-based value and values, people would look at you and say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Or they would laugh. Now, I don't think you can talk to any serious municipal person who doesn't take seriously questions of cooperation and questions of open source information and value creation, right? So I think these kinds of things, we have to put a lot more energy, because when crises like this happen and you do have this intrahegem, as Gramsci would call it, you know, you actually do need the material conditions to create new historic blocks, right? Like, you can't just say to people, okay, this ideology is dead, you know? And I will say, I think a lot of what makes this nostalgia so pertinent is that for a lot of people who are of a certain age range, they are living in a different historical and material reality than those who are younger than them in many ways, because they probably have no relationship with cooperatives. They probably have no relationship with virtual mutual aid societies. They've probably never done crowdfunding before, right? They've probably never been involved in open source problem solving, right? So like for them, the answers are going to be very much narrowed to the kinds of world that they continue to live in. Whereas I think people who are younger, their imagination has been organically expanded because of the fact that the world in which they materially are reproducing themselves in has, you know, not completely so, which often dramatically so, but these are now much more prevalent. So I think that's a big part about how we take what is oftentimes just very generational and make it something
that's definitely the direction that we have to move in. Right. I think what's really pertinent about what you're saying there, Pete, is look at ideologies separate from the way people live their lives. Like ideologies have to connect with at least some aspect of the way you live your life, and they have to connect with some way in which you calculate your own or you sense your own material interests. Do you know what I mean? And I think that does lie at the root of this generation. Mm. Or the political generation gap, I think. And like one way I've been trying to think about it over the last sort of few days is to think about like what is the attraction of this sort of like financialized world to older people? And it is because we basically moved from a post-war era in which, you know, in countries such as UK and also to the US, what you have is sort of like state-backed welfare, right? So the risks associated with your own social reproduction, you know, ultimately they're backed by the state, right? So that, you know, there'll be sort of like some sort of national insurance scheme, et cetera, and by this, old age pensions at least attached to the state in some sort of way. In countries such as the UK, you have National Health Service, so your healthcare will be taken back by the state, and that has obviously been rolled back for like 40 years. And as financialization plays out, what is replacing state-backed is what like financialized mechanisms for dealing with risk, or perhaps we might even say asset-backed welfare system. So like access to credit is your main mechanism through which you can address welfare in times of unemployment, in times of, in the US, in times when, when you're ill, perhaps, or these sorts of things. And what will be proved over the next period, and what people have sensed immediately, is that that sort of like financialized risk is actually not doesn't work. It doesn't work in this sort of circumstances, because what's happened to stock markets, they've just collapsed 35% of value in the last, I think it's a month. And remember when, because remember the stock market crash started with an oil shock from Saudi Arabia. It seems like a different world now. But and so like, so what's the immediate reaction is what we're seeing is this huge capacity of states to act resources. Right, that's what we're seeing over the last 2 weeks. So your immediate action would be, okay, there's been this long-term swing away from state-backed welfare to asset-backed welfare. Asset-backed welfare has shown its real limitations, so we should expect a swing back towards state-backed welfare. But I think what you were saying just then opens up, the prospect of something else. We, what we're really learning when we look at these mutual aid networks is that the only thing that really in terms of need is being embedded in solidaristic communities, right? That's the only thing you can really rely on, right? And so, perhaps what we will see is the swing towards institutionalizations or forms of institutions, which can maintain and continue that sort of like solidaristic communities, which will be things such as the commons, etc. But perhaps one way I'd link that up would be to link it to the work on public common partnerships, which me and my friend Bertie Russell have been doing over the last 18 months or so, which is to think about how, these huge resources which the state can obviously mobilize can be used to massively expand the sort of common sector, right? I think that might be, if I had a choice of the way the world would go after this pandemic, that would be the direction I would go in. And I think so, like some of the, because I earlier on you were talking about, algorithmically managed, platform-based, exclusionary forms of state management. Like, so perhaps lots of the, well, I was talking to my friend Jeremy Gilbert recently, and we were sort of saying, well, look, perhaps what's likely to come out of this is some sort of algorithmically managed return to a sort of form of Keynesianism, a form of Keynesian demand management, but operated via these platforms such as Amazon, etc. Amazon is going to, expand massively over this pandemic. It's going to have a great pandemic, no doubt about it. It's going to buy up loads and loads of failing businesses. It's going to take a huge amount of market share. And so, like for the left, that raises this demand. It can, like, what is your response to that? It is not. It has to, like the whole logic of that is no to algorithms and yes to democratic control over this. So you can have democratic control for via state-backed welfare, but really, real democratic control, as we found out in the post-war nationalizations, which weren't managed democratically, real democratic control is through institutions such as the commons. You know what I mean? So you can see some logic of the situation, which would lead us away from towards perhaps state-enabled commons-based welfare, which is what I would like.
And I think that's, that's really, I mean, important, and it has to be stressed. And I feel like conversation should be part of the conversation, because in the podcast I had with Jeremy, we talked about the fact that, nationalizing the infrastructures of massive platforms like Amazon is a really, I think, strong way forward for thinking about how you start to move towards these kinds of democratically controlled platform economies, planned platform economies. But I also would say that, you know, there's something, and if I could kind of take us in, because I know we have just a little bit more time, but in a slightly different direction, that I don't think that you and I would necessarily always go in, but, you know, if we could be almost sentimental for a moment, which for, I guess, kind of two old school leftists like us is not necessarily our first thing. I've been really struck by the fact that, you know, every single piece of evidence shows that the best way, at least politically, to establish generational solidarity between the young and the old is, you know, and I know it sounds very liberal, but it's just having the time to talk. You know, like younger people, kids, essentially children, grandkids, saying, look, this is why we're so scared. Like, this is, you know, why we need this, you know, and just opening up a dialogue. And I know that's like, you know, for all the things that we've talked about previously, you know, this idea of, you know, kind of radical spaces of conversation is not necessarily the first thing that, you know, we always want to go to, but I do think it's actually not insignificant. And I think that, I'm wondering what you think about this, but I think that, you know, this kind of taking pause as well, you know, it gives us an opportunity to kind of get out of our bubble, so to speak, you know, turn off the cable TV in the US if you're older, maybe get off Facebook a little bit if you're younger.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Instagram, I think. Instagram with comrade Britney Spears. But,
yeah. Exactly. Oh, that was amazing. That was amazing. I feel like another, in a different world, you and I could do a whole series of podcasts just on the revolutionists led by Pamela Anderson and Britney Spears. But, I mean, in all seriousness, you know, I'm wondering what you feel about this, because I know that we spend so much time talking about infrastructures and structures and things, but that this also gives us an opportunity just to actually have radical spaces of intergenerational dialogue, whether that's, you know, through Skyping with each other or WhatsApping with each other, or often, I mean, I know that you mentioned, you know, you're in a situation like a lot of people where your daughter has come home from university and now is in lockdown with you. And I'm wondering if you think that could also be something that, you know, isn't maybe the first thing we think about, but could actually have really profound long-term importance about this lockdown forces us to stop working, get out of our bubbles a little bit.
I mean, yeah, totally, totally.
Speak to each other.
Situation, isn't it? Because it's actually quite hard to teach your neighbors. I do think, you know, basically, like, first things first, like, basically talking to other people and finding, you know, ways in which, like, talking to other people, having been able to talk to other people about what should life be like, is basically the basis of politics. You know, it's very rare that we actually get to the situation where we can talk with other people about what we would like our life to be, or even just to think about what we would like our lives to look like, because most of our lives are by this relentless, hectic pressure of work, basically. So that is one of the prospects that you have when you don't have to go to work, you know, there's less work you can do at home, or that you cut out a lot of the bullshit work that you were hinting at earlier, which people talk about as presentism, where, you know, you just, in fact, what you're doing is tossing it off on Facebook or whatever for 6 hours out of the day. But so that's the prospect, is that, like, your habits of your everyday life are paused, which gives you a certain space to think about what the heck's going on in your life and, you know what you might want the world to look like, you know, which is all the same way saying what your world to look like. That's something that seems very positive. The mutual aid groups, the sort of solidarity that's happening there, is it, you know, that could have really powerful long-term events, because or with the people who will live around you. So that's connecting the bare roots of a community, which could be very, very powerful in the future. But yet it's very difficult to talk physically, because the most natural degree zero of all politics, but particularly left politics, would be the meeting or the mass meeting or the getting together and discussing. which were what the General Assemblies were when it came down to it, and yet we can't do that. We can't have the General Assemblies in the squares. And, the sort of methods of communication that the left is trying to create now, these huge Zoom meetings, and we're really working out, mass meetings, mass politics without co-presence. That's what we're working out at the moment. There are sort of like technological barriers that would separate the generations on that, I think. People have to be trained up to it, and younger people would be more, it would be more native to this world, I think. So it's a, I think, we haven't got a choice about this. We're going to have to work on those contradictions. But it's not a totally hopeless situation, I think. I mean, one of the other things to think about is we basically, we were on the road to disaster way before this pandemic. We were on the road to disaster, which outscales this pandemic by, huge degrees of scale, which is climate change, which is looking at, we are looking at, huge hundreds of millions of deaths in towards the second half of this century, unless things change. In some ways, this pandemic it might have come along just in time, actually, to sort of knock us off this path that we were seem to be impotent or immobile in the face of it. And like addressing this pandemic could give us some of the answers to how we address this other huge looming crisis in which we have to, we really do have to transform the economy. In fact, one of the ways in which people talked about it was that, we'd left it so long before we'd acted that now we needed the sort of scale of transformation in this short period of time to deal with climate change and move from a carbon-based to a non-carbon-based economy and, to move towards, if not a no-growth economy, then a low-growth and a different growth economy, which involves valuing the world differently. That sort of mobilization was the sort of mobilization of resources that was previously only ever seen in sort of like wartime periods or perhaps following revolutions. But we're also seeing that sort of mobilization, or we should be seeing that mobilization in the face of this pandemic. Do you know what I mean? And so it seems to me that if we do manage to deal with this pandemic, we're getting as close to get as possible towards UBR, the democratically planned allocation of resources. When we have the model of how you deal with the climate change crisis, and it seems hard to think that we wouldn't come out of this in a better position to deal with climate change. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And I think that, as I said previously, because I think you're absolutely on point, is that the notion of neoliberal resiliency has now been radicalized. And the question is, how are we going to create progressive resilience structures? And I think, in a sense, the movement away from capitalism has gone, and I think this is probably the place that we can, present it is really gone from ethical and moral to survival, right? So it's like, we don't have a choice anymore. Like, at the end of the day, the move away from how things are right now, from a market economy, from capitalism, is not because we think it would be a good idea, not because, it has a lot of exploitation, not because there's so much injustice, because like our very survival across generations depends on it. So I think, if there's anything
that we sort of moved from socialism or barbarism seemed to be the option a little while ago, but now it's clear it's socialism, which is an old slogan, but that is no longer a commitment. It's just a statement of fact.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's perfect. Well, again, Keir, it's always amazing to have you on. I know this is going to be, one of many conversations that we're going to have over the years. So I really appreciate it. And, another world is, possible. And
I really enjoyed that. Like, it's really useful to be forced to think these things through. And we're basically just we're collectively trying to work our way through this situation. So I think really valuable at this moment.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and remember, until next time, another world is not only possible, but happening right now.